I'm David Ropeek, and this is The Connection. For some, community theater is the stuff of jokes, like, you know you're in community theater when your sofa spends more time on stage than you do. Ba-dum-bum. For others, though, it's the stuff of dreams. It makes them feel alive, connected, part of a world transformed. Every night in small towns and cities across America, the young and the old, the talented and the, well, not so talented, leave behind day jobs as electricians and beauticians, librarians and lawyers, shed their working skins and remind us that all the world's a stage if you and your neighbors decide to make it one, and that even adults can have fun making believe. These are the people that Leah Hager-Cohn talks to, lives with, and celebrates in her book that chronicles a year in the life of a community theater. Connection listeners, do you love community theater? If so, is it the stage or the socializing that keeps you coming back? We're making the community theater connection this hour. Join us, but be warned, you'll be asked to sing or read a line. Dancing doesn't work on the radio, from your favorite production. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio now by Leah Hager-Cohn, author of The Stuff of Dreams, Behind the Scenes of American Community Theater. Leah Hager-Cohn, welcome.
Thank you.
And we're also joined on the line by Celia Couture, who Leah knows well. She is the director of the Arlington Friends of Drama, the theater chronicled in Leah's book. Celia?
Hi.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Leah, let's start with what this passion is all about. Boy, you know, I know people who have, like, no life except for their love for community theater. Explain it from your personal perspective.
I think probably there's as many answers as there are people involved in community theater, but I think at the bottom of every answer it would be the passion for something huge and mysterious. You know, I mean, not unlike the passion for God.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, I've encountered a number of people who like the spotlight. Duh. But I've also encountered a number of people who go to move the sofas around or turn the lights on and be backstage, who talk about it with the same vigor and energy because of the community they get out of it, not the theater, if you will. Have you experienced that too? Or are you a kind of being on the stage type?
Oh, personally, I've experienced both pieces. One of my favorite interviews that I did for the book was with a woman, Nancy Richardson, who called the theater a Lonely Hearts Club, which at first I thought was sort of demeaning, you know, and embarrassing for the people who are in the theater to think of themselves as lonely hearts or being there out of lonely-heartedness. But then I thought it was something really beautiful the more she talked about it, and that, you know, lonely-heartedness is sort of part of the human condition, and coming together to make plays, whether it's moving the sofas or being in the spotlight, is I think, an answer, a response to that.
And in fact, true lonely heart would be at home. These are people who come out, those for the sense of community, to join and create family and to celebrate that, after all. But you do talk about your love of being on the stage a little bit in your book, and so can we ask you to read that wonderful passage in your prologue about your first encounter when you were, what, 10 or 11 or 12 with acting? Go ahead.
I acted in one play, in one scene, and fell in love. I loved everything about it, loved the high-buttoned boots I wore and the way they clacked along the bumpy cement floor of the dressing room. Loved the hush of the audience as the play opened, and the dark lumpiness of them breathing out there, beyond the dust motes and the stage lights. I loved the motley melange of props crowding the back room where we waited to go on. Loved the watered-down Coke we used for claret, and the shaving cream we used for vanilla ice cream. Above all, I loved the building, both the plaintively shabby physical structure and the intangible fact of the place, a whole building existing only for pretend, for the elaborate devotional practice of play, of playing, of exploring imagined lives.
Wonderful. And you use the word a lot in there, loved. Strength of feeling. Let me ask Celia how you came by your involvement in community theater, your personal story, and why you're not doing this as a pro. I mean, we think of community theater as a amateur endeavor. How'd you come by it?
Well, actually, I didn't really start even realizing I would even enjoy it until college, when a friend coaxed me into auditioning for a performance of Oklahoma. And I kind of, went there very skeptical because, you know, my background was always athletics in high school. So I go to this audition, and ironically, I'm cast, and my friend isn't. And that kind of started me on my way.
Who were you?
I played the grandmother, believe it or not.
Can you remember any of the music or any of the lines?
You're not going to make me sing, David.
Well, I can't force you. I can invite you.
I'm the behind-the-scenes kind of person.
All right. We'll let you be a sofa mover today.
Okay.
Talk about this difference between professional and community theater. There are many people who go do community theater who, aren't good enough, don't have the time. Where does the division happen?
Well, I think for me personally, I think to do this professionally requires a great deal of sacrifice. I mean, I have friends that have been in New York or L.A. trying to make it now for 30-plus years, and I don't think I was willing to make that much of a sacrifice. So for me, it became more of a hobby.
And an avocation of love, as Leah has used the word, I'm sure, as the director of the Arlington Friends of Drama. How much time, when they're really in the heat of a production, do you invest in that versus work?
Well, the whole process is for me, a year-long process. From the time I'm hired to direct the show till the time I'm deeply involved in it for the 6 or 8 week time frame to put the production together, it's a year of your life. Because you know, you're involved in research, you're involved in working with designers, and because we all have real-life jobs, all of this is done after work hours.
Now, Leah, this book was your real-life job, and you were not a performer in the M. Butterfly production, which was, over the course of the year, what you wrote about. What made you leave the stage, pick up the pen, and write this book?
I hadn't been on the stage in a long time, in about 8 years, and, you know, like Celia's saying, I think there were circumstances in my life that made my life really busy and made theater not seem like an option. You know, and when you just said that this book was my job while I was working on it, you know, I was just thinking, lucky, lucky, lucky. You know, I was getting to do what I loved as my main course and not having to fit it in, you know, as a secret indulgence when I could. So I guess I was still harboring this passionate curiosity and affinity for theater, especially amateur theater, and you know, how lucky I was to be able to choose to come to it during my work hours, in a sense, and explore it from that angle.
Did you want to be acting in it, or was it okay to watch this one?
I think that time I was so involved in the story. I was coming to it as a storyteller that time, and it was so great to be able to really watch Celia and everybody else at work in a way that I wouldn't have been able to if I were being directed by her.
Celia, how ambitious can you be with the amateurs who come in, some of whom are new? You know, you're looking for a certain degree of talent, and you have a vision, and you really want them to emote and do this and that, but it's amateur theater, and, you know, they're not getting paid, so you can't crack the whip too hard. How do you approach the wanting it to be so much? How aggressive can you be?
Oh, I think, you know, I think people that do community theater bring with them that passion and that desire anyway. So I think, you know, my involvement and my experience with these folks is that they take this very, very seriously. And that as a director, I owe them just as much as I would owe a professional performer in terms of preparation and concept and vision. And, you know, I'm working with young people right now who, you know, they'll tell me absolutely, the harder you make me work, the better.
Well, they may have the passion, but they may not have all of the ability that you would want nonetheless. Do you have to tailor, for example, what plays you do? You know, what performances you choose in the first place, knowing the caliber of the talent, not the passion, that'll be coming in?
Well, you know, in the case of M. Butterfly, I think we also made the assumption that this was a pretty challenging piece of theater to try to perform at the community theater level, and I'm proud to say the talent came to us. So people in community theater circles who have the talent will apply their skills even to more challenging pieces. And that's been my experience doing this 20-plus years. You may have to, I guess a director of community theater does a lot more mentoring, perhaps, than with professional performers. We do a lot more teaching. There's a lot more analysis of objective and the literature and where the playwright is coming from, perhaps. But I've even had experiences where community theater performers have done all their homework before they walk into the first rehearsal.
And I imagine some of them walk in, even though they're beginners and amateurs, with no small amount of ego about they should get this role and that. And how, as a director, do you deal with that?
Clearly. But you get ego in any profession, in any avocation. And you would deal with it exactly the same way. You know, I assess who gets a role based on my vision and how that individual works with everybody else I'm casting.
And then massage the egos as you go.
Absolutely. just like you would in any kind of teaming environment.
And you're right, there are egos in all professions, absolutely.
Right.
But especially, I would imagine, the one that wants to be in the spotlight. Leah, let me turn to you. You were headed on this path of being in the theater and then changed. Why? Tell us about that.
Yeah, I'm just remembering when I was most seriously headed on that path and how I was a drama student at the Stella Adler Conservatory at New York University, and it was, you know, we just all wore black, and, you know, we were so filled with we took ourselves so seriously. You know, I was going to say we were filled with serious pretensions, and they were pretensions, but they were earnest pretensions, and I don't mean to belittle who we all were at that time, but I think finally I just, you know, I was 16 and I was spending so much time focusing inward on my body as an instrument, and it seemed a little out of balance with the idea that at age 16 you might be learning about the world outside you. So for me, I diverted to another path at that point.
Silly, are the folks that come to you people who had professional pretensions at some point and are frustrated, wish I was something else's?
Oh, sure. I've had a mix of people that I've worked with for years that are kind of both. Or they've tried it and they've come back. You know, this is too difficult. It's too much of a sacrifice. And I'm back in community theater now, where I can still experience and use my skills and have fun doing it without, you know, this threat of no food on the table over my head if I don't make it professionally.
Celia Couture, thank you for being with us. One last question for Leah before we go to the break. What do you find in the passion of why people come to community theater? Broad question, but in a minute or so.
I think, you know, you brought this up. People have different passions. Some are for lending a hand, the same way you might lend a hand to someone whose barn burned down a long time ago. And for others, I think it is more about being on the stage, that feeling of connecting with an audience and having great approval. And people I spoke with often use the word love, that the feeling of love coming to them from the audience or the ensemble they were working with.
Leah Hager-Combs, thank you very much. Celia Couture from Arlington, thank you very much for being with us. You are listening to the Community Theater Connection, and be prepared for singing and speaking and imagining dancing as the connection continues. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. You are listening to The Connection on NPR.
From both.
I'm David Ropeek. This is the Community Theater Connection, and this is an audition scene from a wonderful movie about community theater, Waiting for Guffman.
Ding dong!
Oh, I wonder who knows I'm vacationing here at the Oasis.
Am I late?
You!
Surprised?
How did you find me?
I have my ways.
Would you like to come in for coffee? You don't need to answer. There's no need to speak. I'll be your belly dancer, prancer.
And I will be your sheep.
Oh, thank you.
Good. That was great.
Yeah, right. Singers who can't but want to. Leah, what happens in the life of... You chronicle for a year this somewhat controversial production that the Arlington Theater did. Tell us about that in condensed version, the cycles, the narrative of that year.
It was a little bit of a controversial decision to perform or to produce M. Butterfly at the community theater. It dealt with a transgender love affair. It had nudity. It dealt with Asian themes and required an Asian male lead who could get naked on stage and convincingly portray a woman. So it was quite challenging for...
Not a church play, huh?
No. Okay. No. And then Celia made it clear that she wouldn't even go on with the play unless she could cast it to her standards. So for a while it was in question, you know, whether it would even go on. And then she was able to cast it. And then there was some of, you know, the usual travails with the rehearsal process. Would it all come together?
Describe a little bit of that. Travails.
Yeah, I mean, everything from sort of staying within budget. The costumes turned out to be very expensive because the very talented costume designer was building, you know, elaborate Asian costumes from scratch. Would the chemistry work between the two male leads, you know, and that was such an interesting process to see these two very different people over the course of 6 weeks, you know, grow their relationship both in real life as Patrick and Jimmy, those are their real life names, and their relationship on stage as Song and Gallimard.
A growing tension as it nears opening night?
I think it was roller coastering more than a steadily building tension, because things began to come along and work beautifully, but then other, you know, sort of wrenches would get thrown into the works. So, you know, it would be two steps forward and one step back and a sort of surprise upset right before the play went on, and then finally everything coming together. So there's a whole drama, you know, before you even get to the lights go down and the curtains come up and you have the drama on stage.
And you talked a little bit about, given the nature of the play, a tension as to whether anybody would be there. Was that tension still there going into the first night? Or had all the players and sofa movers sold all the tickets to their relatives and filled the house?
That probably didn't happen quite as much as usual because, you know, people who might have invited their... You know, this is a sort of ageist, but people who might have invited their grandmothers down to see Oklahoma might not have invited the same grandmothers down to see M. Butterfly. Okay. A funny thing is that at AFD, there's a senior dress rehearsal. It's a custom that the senior citizens from the senior center across the street are always invited for free to come watch the dress rehearsal. And, you know, everyone was sort of wondering, well, should we do it with this show? And there was one member of Arlington Friends of the Drama who is great. She said, you know, I take aerobics with a lot of these women and men too. And, you know, absolutely. And they've seen it all before. You can't shock those guys and, you know, bring them in. And so they had their senior dress rehearsal that went on.
How'd it go?
Well, there were, you know, audible cries of Jesus, you know, and is that a boy or is that a girl? And, you know, it's a funny dress rehearsal because the audience members at that one tend to be unabashed about commenting out loud. And a few people walked out after the big nude scene, but it got a standing ovation, which is really unusual, I'm told.
Well, that's awesome. Connection listeners, the Community Theater Connection. Join it, please, and be prepared to perform, perhaps, at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Bruce is calling.
Bruce? Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. You got anything you want to do for us first?
They told me I had to sing first. So
well, not had to, but we'd like you to.
Well, all I know is getting to know you, getting to know all about you. How's that?
Well, that's good enough.
Getting to know you, getting to love all your charms. All right, don't kill me anymore.
I won't. Welcome to the conversation.
How are you?
We're all well.
Well, I just wanted to call in and let you know, I got involved in theater about 10 years ago, and I got so smitten by it, I started my own theater, and I do some productions, Stanley B. Theater, in Boston, and we're community, semi-professional. Sometimes we have extra money and we give it to actors, but we're doing Glengarry Glen Ross in June, and the point of my call is I was so taken when I got involved in theater kind of by accident that it changed my life to the point where if I don't do it, I don't feel as though I'm alive.
Well, Bruce, let me push that a little. What smote you? How did you get smoten?
The truth of the matter is, I come from a background of athleticism, weightlifting, machismo behavior, so to speak, and I never thought that arts or theater was anything a real man would get involved in. And I met a woman who was an actress, and I hung around it. And much to my surprise, it was intriguing, but of course I didn't want to admit it. And then as time passed, I kind of stepped into it. I got involved in a show. They needed a big guy to hold a spear to the left, so to speak. And I did it, and as the show progressed, it was an amazing vision of unity, of work, of teamwork, of emotions, and then sadness. When it ended, I was so overwhelmed when it was coming to an end, I couldn't believe it. I thought I'd have to leave the room and get the allergies out of my eyes. I felt so smitten by what happened to me, but it made my head explore things I never would consider. I started to read books I never looked at. I listened to music I never thought I'd listen to. It changed my whole way of thinking.
And it certainly made you a wonderful singer.
we act. Glengarry Glen Ross, Boston Center for the Arts in June. But the point is, the people you meet in community theater, some are very, very good. Some aren't so good. Some want to go on. Some want to stay. But it will change your life. And if you want to go see good theater anywhere in Boston and not go broke paying the big prices, check out your community theaters. You would be surprised what you see.
Bruce, thank you very much. We now also have with us on the line from Topeka, Kansas, Twink Lynch, past president of the American Association of Community Theater and volunteer with the Topeka Civic Theater. Twink, before the questions, you ready to perform?
Oh, I don't perform. I just count money.
Okay. Well, then we'll move immediately to the questions and not embarrass you.
Good.
You've been involved in a lot of productions.
Yes.
What is it, do you think, that draws people to community theater? Ain't the Bucks.
Well, no, it certainly isn't. But I think there are a lot of different reasons that people participate. I think sometimes it's because they're new to a community and they're looking for friends and relationships. I think sometimes it's because they, like myself, they can't not do it. They are a theater person and they've been that way all their lives. I think sometimes it's because they get a chance to stretch new skills that they didn't know they had, and the theater allows them to learn how to design or become a better actor or singer like Bruce, or just in some way learn new skills. For example, I myself started out as a playwright and I ended up as a fundraiser. So it's amazing the journey you can travel in community theater.
Is it okay to count coins instead of be in the spotlight?
Oh, of course, because the theaters can't do without the bean counters. It has to pay the bills to stay in business. And if somebody isn't responsible for that kind of work, then as good as the actors may be, the theater group can't survive.
And a coin is the coin of the realm, after all. Is
sure.
Community theater suffering for lack of coin, or is it growing? There is this passion, but it has to be supported. Out there, you were in this association. Is it growing? What's happening with it?
Well, I think it's at least holding its own, if not growing. I think the energy that starts a community theater is everywhere. And I think there are a lot of groups that get started because they just can't not do some theater. But in order to grow, I think you have to develop a decent board, and you have to know how to scale your house and, you know, do all the practical things that keep you in business. And I don't know of a community theater that feels they have it made. Every year, the budget is a struggle. And, looking for earned income and contributed income, and those issues are very major in every community theater I know about.
I understand you have a fabulous story to tell about, and I'll try to sing it, Man of La Mancha, and that's about all I know from the entire play. Tell us.
Well, yes, back when I was a performer, I was the housekeeper in our production of Man of La Mancha, and my husband, who's an orthopedic surgeon, played the innkeeper. And on the second night of performance, our Don Quixote fell. He had an accident, got, you know, out of balance.
Knocked off by the windmill, no doubt.
Right. And he fell against the support of the orchestra pit, the two-by-fours that surrounded the orchestra pit. And he had a compound fracture of his arm where the bone was actually coming through the skin. It was terrible. It was in toward the end of the first act. And so we had to stop the show. My husband...
The play did not go on.
No, it did.
Oh.
That's the point.
Oh, goodness. Go ahead.
My husband took him to the hospital and arranged for surgery for later in the evening. My husband then came back, sang his big number in the second act. In the meantime, we took the captain of the guard, that actor, and turned him into Don Quixote. And while he had a magnificent singing voice and he knew the structure of the play, he was not an understudy. And so all of us that were still in the show pushed him around from place to place to make sure he was in the right place. And then when my husband was through with his aria, he went to the hospital, did surgery on Don Quixote, who then came on for the rest of the performances the following weeks. But we got a standing ovation. The people still talk about that, and it happened 26 years ago. It was a fabulous night. It was a real example of the show can go on.
The show, wow. What a hero.
Yeah, it was great.
Connection listeners, I'm sure you have your stories, too. Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Twink, thank you, although you didn't sing. Perhaps John Church is a better singer than you or I. John, join us. John, are you there with us?
Hello.
Hello. You're on, buddy. That's your cue.
Yeah, John March.
Oh, I'm sorry. I misspoke.
Yeah. And you want a performance?
How about a brief one. Go ahead, as long as it's not lewd.
Wizard of Oz.
Go ahead.
Why, anybody can have a brain. That's a very mediocre commodity. Back where I come from, men go to universities, and when they come out, why, they have no more brains than you. But they have one thing you haven't got, a diploma.
And as I understand it, you have one. What do you do for a real living?
My day job is I'm a trial lawyer.
So you're like the green wizard behind the curtain.
Well, last this November and December, I was, yes.
Okay.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
That's right. What's your love of this?
Well, in my job as a trial lawyer, everything I do is adversarial. There's somebody on the other side of me that's trying to prevent me from accomplishing what I'm trying to accomplish. And so when I go over to the community theater here in Grand Rapids, I'm working with people who are all working together to try and make the audience laugh, cry, sigh, swoon, whatever, hopefully all at the right time. So I enjoy that about it. And plus, it's a different group of people than the people that I spend most of my day with. They see the world a little differently, and so I enjoy that diversity. And then finally, I'd say I just it addresses a creative need that I have, and so it brings a great pleasure to my life and is a real part of my life.
John, thank you. And Leah, who is still with us, please join in at any moment. Let me give you my one experience very briefly. I was in a little church play, not nearly as formal as the Arlington Friends and so forth, never having acted before. It was wonderful. And it was the camaraderie and the community, as John, you suggested, and Leah, you suggested, more than, you know, I couldn't recite any of my lines, not that I'd have the courage to anyway. The camaraderie seems to run through all of this. Talk about that.
Oh, me?
Well, either of you, sure. It's a conversation.
Well, when you were talking, I was just thinking about the parallels to children's play and make-believe. And you know, it seems like camaraderie is an underlying part of what's going on when kids are feeling their way through an afternoon of make-believe.
Camaraderie amongst them? They're all having this unique together experience?
And that they're actually constructing a sort of counter-reality together. You know, don't you remember then when you would be called into supper and there was that feeling of, you know, they, the parents, have no idea who I've just been. You know, I've just been, you know, a warrior and, you know, this person's just been, you know, the lion and this other person's just been the fairy. And, you know, they don't even know our story, but our story is so real. We've just been living it for the past 3 hours.
The fantasy. Now, John, tell me, if you're still there with us, please.
Yeah.
The feeling of family and community that you seem to speak of that seems unique to that group that forms around a production. Describe that.
Well, I think that there are people who come from all walks of life. They do different things during the day, but they all come together. and there's a real sense of devotion to this cause. And I'm an actor. I don't do much backstage, but some of the people who support the productions, the stagehands, the crew, they spend tremendous amounts of time. They never appear on stage, but they do it because this sense of accomplishment when we're finished and we've got a production that the audience enjoys, it's just a real high.
And a sense of belonging to one another as well?
I think so, yes. A sense of working together for a common end and contributing to the community life. I think that's very important.
John, thank you for calling. And we have more performers ready to perform. And you can join the list at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Arthur is on the line. Hum a few bars, Art.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have to say that I've never sung before, and I was told I had to. So I'm gonna
well, you're anonymous and let her rip.
Here we go. From the classic Oklahoma, I guess. Oklahoma, where the wind comes sweeping down the plain, where the waving wheat can sure smell sweet, and the wind comes right behind the rain. Something like that, anyway.
Well, I'm sure when agents call, we'll pass along your phone number. What is your love of all of this?
Well, I got involved with community theater later in life, I guess in my late 30s or so, and went to an audition about 2 hours after I'd had a root canal, and they gave me the lead.
And which was worse, the root canal or acting?
Probably just before I go on stage, I would prefer a root canal, but once I'm out there, it's very different. But it was a Neil Simon comedy, and I found this incredible ability or a power, I guess, to hold and to move an audience. I got mostly involved in comedies, I guess, at the time, and did a very good job at it. And it's one of the things that I can say I'm good at is acting. But a couple of years after I was doing it, I did get a part in a movie where I actually had lines, and I have to say, even though it was a small part, once I was finished with my part in the movie, I found that the community theater was a lot more fun. After the glamour wore off about working with actual movie stars, it was very a lot of drudgery, a lot of sitting around, a lot of just waiting.
But the camaraderie was there in the community theater briefly because we have to go to a break.
Absolutely, the camaraderie was there. And also, I just want to mention,
I'm afraid I can't let you just mention, I apologize, only because the show is formatted to have a break coming up. Thank you for your courage in singing. Connection listeners, we're talking about community theater and performing. You are listening to The Connection on NPR.
From both.
This is, as Sir John Gielgud might say, The Connection. No, I'm sorry, that was terrible, but that's why I'm not an actor. We're talking about community theater with Leah Hager-Cohen. And our previous caller, who I had to interrupt, unfortunately, Arthur, raised a good point in your mind about the tension. You know, it's not all glowy and rosy in community as opposed to professional theater. Explain it.
Well, when the past caller was contrasting his experience in a professional film versus community theater and saying that he preferred community theater, it made me think about something I heard a lot from Arlington Friends of the Drama members. And there was a fair amount of grousing about some productions getting so caught up in having really fine theatrical standards, fine professional standards, that it was edging out the amount of time for the community aspect of community theater, the sort of going out for coffee after, or just even having tolerance for people cutting up during rehearsal and creating that family vibe.
You called it community-ishness, I think, or something like that. But I understand what you mean, that the tension between people who really want to do it like pro, you know, even they have visions of being pro maybe, and the folks who have come to this wanting to have a good, relaxed community time. Is that common?
I think so. There's this woman, Ellen Kazin, at Arlington Friends of the Drama, who taught me this Yiddish word I had never heard before, Hamish. You know, she said, yeah, you know, community theater is supposed to be Hamish. If it's not Hamish, if it's not family feeling and fun and warm, you know, stay home.
But a lot of people come to it to want to be excellent.
That's true. And I think very often people come to it with both of those desires, and they dovetail beautifully, and, you know, it's not necessarily a source of tension, but it can be. It can be whenever someone feels like it's getting too much one way or the other.
I must say that the one time I did this on the church stage, the director wanted it to be as good as he could, and we wanted to hang out and have wine afterwards. And the tension was between us and him. All of us were cool. He was like, let's make this good, guys, like his ego was on the line. We have the opportunity to have you join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we are joined by Ann Cannon, president and all-around volunteer in Burnie, Texas. Ann, are you prepared to give us a bit of a performance?
Yes, it's Burnie, Texas.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. I can't speak or act.
From Christmas Carol, I was the laundress, one of the three people who is selling old Scrooge's belongings to the pawnbroker during the Christmas yet-to-come scene. And I would come out and say, if he'd wanted to keep anything after he was dead, the mean old screw, why wasn't he more natural about it when he was alive? He'd have had somebody to look after him when death struck him, instead of lying there gasping out his last alone all by himself.
Oh, we're going to have to put that one on in the office after the show. Thank you for your courage. You work with an all-volunteer community theater, no coin involved. What's that like?
Well, there is a lot of coin involved.
Well, of course.
None of it goes to the volunteers, though. We still have to pay rent, utilities. We have to pay royalties. We have to pay to build our sets and frequently buy our props. So, yes, we do still have our finger on the money.
Okay, but the nature of your theater and, you know, a small town in Texas, what's it mean to your community to have this?
We hope that it means a great deal to them. We tell them that we're Burnie's nonprofit community theater, and we try to become an important member of the community, not just in having people come to our shows to see us, but also in reaching out to the community. We give a $500 scholarship to a graduating Burnie High School senior each year. And right now we're doing a show where all of the money that we take in goes to the local family services agency.
A community is, after all, a plaid of woven threads of different colors, if I can use that metaphor. What role do you think community theater plays in a community having a unique sense about itself? Well, we're cool. We got a theater.
I think that it gives the community a sense of pride. We're a little bit far away from, we're about 30 miles from San Antonio, which has a lot of community theaters, but we like the idea, the community does, of having a theater right in its own backyard. Most of the people who are involved in the theater know most of the other people in the town. So you get to have that feeling of, oh, it's my neighbor, my friend, who is here either on the set, on the stage or behind the scenes or selling me the ticket.
And Boston has its Pops, and Burnie has its Backdoor Theater. Ann, thank you very much.
Sure.
Connection listeners, be prepared to perform if you call in. We'd like you to anyway, at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Leslie, are you there, and what do you have for us?
Yes, hello.
Go right ahead.
Yes, I can't believe that you're offering actual live performance on the air and you haven't got lots of people eager to perform. It's incredible.
We do. Go ahead.
I'm ready. Yes, by way of introduction, I'm playing the part of Major General Stanley in our local production, which includes both high school students, which is part of my point, and adults this weekend of Pirates of Penzance. And Major General Stanley comes out at the end of the first act and sings, I am the very model of a modern Major General. I've information, vegetable, animal, and mineral. I know the kings of England, and I quote the fight's historical. From Marathon to Waterloo in order categorical. I am very well acquainted, too, with math as mathematical. I understand equations both simple and quadratical. About binomial theorems, I am teeming with a lot of news. With many triple facts about the square of the hypotenuse. And then I need a chorus to do the response. So
oh, but first you need our round of applause. Absolutely courageous and well done, and I will never forget watching that sung on the front of a boat in an episode of The Simpsons.
Oh, really?
How do you come by your passion for this?
I'm an old folk music performer who just needed a place to perform. not to take too much of your time, let me make my point here, which is that, which no one has so far, that I'm involved with a group that's maintaining an old 1890s 400-seat vaudeville house down in Putnam, Connecticut. And one of the most amazing things I've seen happen in community theater is what happens with the young people who get involved. Like a lot of amateur theater, we have at least two or three performances a year, which are intended to include a lot of young people, both because it brings adults in, brings money into the theater, and because it's our next crop of actors. And the kids come in, and they're exposed to a situation where they're working with adults in a context that they don't find almost anywhere else in society right now. It's very similar to athletics in the sense that when you get your cue, by golly, you've got to come up with your lines. There's no excuses allowed. But the reward is a sense of triumph every time. You know, you can't lose the game. And the kids go away with a sense of who they are and what they can accomplish that they just don't seem to get any other way, and it attracts kids who don't get the athletic experience. So if for no other reason than that, I would support amateur theater. And I'd really urge people, you know, not to treat, when you come out to the audience, when you come out to amateur theater, don't go looking for the faults, because you'll find plenty of them, and you'll go away unhappy and dissatisfied. Go looking for the magic moments, the people with the good voices or the wonderful emotion. There are plenty of magic moments and great emotion in fine theater that'll happen up there, and if you go looking for those, you'll find them, and you'll come back for more. It's really a wonderful experience on both sides.
Leslie, what a wonderful, wonderful thought, and how appropriate to raise the issue of preserving this part of our culture, which, Leah, your book will help do. As you've written the book, and Arlington is a well-established theater, talk about that. Is this a fading part of our culture, a growing one?
Well, it's interesting you mention that now, because the previous two callers have, in different ways, addressed the community service aspect of community theater. The woman from Bernie, Texas, talking about giving scholarship money and doing benefit performances, and this most recent call talking about what it does for children and a sense of building self-strength. And I just wanted to read something that was written by Percy McKay, who wrote this in 1917, around the time that the little theater movement or community theater movement was starting in this country. He said, "It is precisely because our piece is so devoid of organized constructive imagination that the organized destruction of war appeals so potently to the imaginations of men by giving scope for their qualities of spiritual heroism. What the world is waiting for is to be found, I believe, in the basic method of social service involved in community drama." So he was putting it on that high a level of social service.
Say that last part again. Oh, you've lost your page, but social service.
Yes, what the world is waiting for is to be found, I believe, in the basic method of social service involved in community drama. He saw it as a basic part of our civic fabric, our social structure, that you know, a healthy part of building a society was to be found in amateur theater, the little theater movement, as it was called in those early days and at the beginning of the century.
This theme keeps coming up: social, society, family, community, quite apart from being in the spotlight. Connection listeners, we'd have time for a couple more performances, hopefully. 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Paula, are you with us, and is your courage ready? Paula, are you there?
Oh, hello. Sorry.
Hello. Welcome.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm sorry, I can't sing.
That's all right. You needn't sing. Dancing doesn't work on the radio. You don't even have to perform. You can just participate in the conversation.
Yeah, I just have a question, I guess, for Leah, about this notion that she brought up, and that, in fact, all of the callers have been bringing up, of play, of the freedom that they get from not doing this professionally, from just playing like children. I believe that Leah, you actually talked about this earlier in the hour, you equated it with childhood play. And I just want to ask a little bit about what happens as a result of that, and to wonder whether that goes away if and when people do start getting more professionalized.
Well, I certainly think it tends to go away just plain as we grow up. And the whole idea of amateur, which I think is so great, and the root word, you know, amateur's root lying in to love, doing something out of love. I think that the sense of love as well as play can disappear when something becomes a paid profession, a professional pursuit, you know, and the difference between, you know, my children who like to sort of, you know, crawl around meowing and licking people's knees, you know, which is pure play and which is, you know, not unlike what then becomes acting, imagining yourself into other people's lives or other cats' lives or, you know, whatever thing you're playing at, I think is there is a difference between that and doing something because you're a hired professional and you're delivering a product.
Paula, thank you for the call. And now we go to Jack in Spokane, who may or may not be ready to perform. Jack, welcome.
Or may not be ready, yes. actually, I wanted to suggest to you that when you do the introduction to this piece, you talked about fourth grade performances, and you've been spending a lot of time, in a sense, kind of kidding about the amateur side of it. And indeed, I think that some of the best community theater in the country is really very good quality. There are over 7,000 community theaters in the country. Last year, 83 million people attended, were ticket holders of community theater. That makes it the largest single sporting or arts event in the country.
83 million people. Of course, it's a heck of a lot more affordable than a Broadway ticket. That may be part of it. Why do you think that is?
I think because of all the things you're talking about. It's a sense of community. Some of it is a sense of seeing your friends. Some of it is the pride that goes with having a really good community theater connected with your town.
Jack, thank you very much. We have a couple minutes left, and we threatened, cajoled, and arm-twisted Leah that in exchange for her performance, for her discussion here of the book, if there was something she would like to recite of a line or sing or perform, our guest got to do that too as the last note. And we should tell you, listeners, that she's had the chance to rehearse a little bit. Leah?
Well, this is something I put in the book. I love it so much. It's there's this obscure Al Carmine's musical. Well, I guess that's redundant, but there's this Al Carmine's musical called Promenade with a song in it with a line that goes, I know what madness is. It's not knowing how another man feels. A madman's never walked in another man's shoes. And I like that because I think, you know, by this definition of madness, theater is really a form of edging towards sanity.
And yet, a madman who's never walked in another man's shoes. The one time I acted, I was stepping into another man's shoes. It was quite sane to be pretending to be somebody else, the make-believe of adulthood. It can be that too, no?
I think that's the point of the line, is that if you don't have the ability to empathize or to ever imagine yourself into someone else's life, that you're lacking, you're in some way not quite fully, healthily human.
Thank you very much, Leah Hager-Cohen, who is the author of Stuff of Dreams, Behind the Scenes of an American Community Theater. We spoke earlier with Celia Couture, director of Arlington Friends of the Drama, and Twink Lynch, former president of the American Association of Community Theater and volunteer with the Topeka Civic Theater. We spoke with many and listened to the singing of many of the others of you. Thank you for your courage in participating. We had help today on The Connection from Glenn Alexander, Kim Bashari, Sean Carberry, Darren Manoogian, Doug Sugertz, and from interns Tom Gilmore and Sandy Margolin. The Connection is produced by Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Michael Kavanaugh, Allison McAdam, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Ben Walker. Senior producer is Graham Smith. To continue the community theater conversation, you can visit our website, theconnection.org. I'm David Ropeek. This is The Connection.
By the pool, in the school, by the thighs of you. It's the rule. There's a stool, there's a stool. Stools are rare. Once upon a time you find a chair. A chair's for fools. Everybody wants to. From the bottom to the pool.
This is double.